Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
OHCHR has just a few minutes ago reported on a multitude of reports of summary executions of unarmed men and civilians in El Fasher.
The United Nations is repeating its call for an immediate ceasefire in Sudan after the UAE-backed rapid support forces seized control of Al Fasher and Darfur after a 17-month siege. Mass reports of atrocities in the city. We'll get the latest. Then the U.S. government shutdown has entered its 28th day. Almost 1.5 million federal workers are going without pay. Many are turning to food pantries to eat. As 42 million people will soon lose food assistance through the SNAP program, millions are also facing soaring health care premiums as Republicans refuse to extend subsidies for the Affordable Care Act.
Trump and congressional Republicans have refused to extend the enhanced subsidies for Marketplace ACA plans. 20 million Americans get Marketplace ACA plans, and they're going to see their premium costs more than double.
Then David Sirota of The Lever on Master Plan, the hidden plot to legalize corruption in America. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Officials in Jamaica are warning of an unfolding catastrophe as Hurricane Melissa bears down on the island nation with sustained winds of up to 175 miles per hour. The Category 5 storm is the strongest on Earth this year and the most powerful hurricane on record ever to strike Jamaica, likely to trigger widespread flooding and landslides with catastrophic damage to buildings in the path of the hurricane's eye. Some parts of Jamaica could see up to 40 inches of rain, more rain than typically falls in an entire year. Melissa's already killed three people each in Jamaica and Haiti, and one person in the Dominican Republic. Hurricane warnings are also in effect for parts of Cuba and the Bahamas. Meanwhile, many Haitians fear the storm could worsen the humanitarian crisis in Haiti, where residents already face widespread poverty and gang violence. This is Fortune Vital, a resident of a camp for displaced people in Haiti's western Lekai region.
We have nothing in our hands to live on. If a hurricane hits, we're screwed. If the hurricane comes on top of all the problems we already have, we'll simply die. My kids, my wife, and my family are somewhere else. We have nothing to eat to survive. This adds to the problem of bandits shooting all day. There's no way out except to die.
The hurricane exploded in strength from a tropical storm on Saturday to a Category 4 hurricane on Sunday, a rapid intensification made possible by abnormally warm waters in the Caribbean. Climate scientists say human activity is causing oceans to warm dramatically, making rapidly developing storms more common. The United Nations top official says the world has failed to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, the goal set by the Paris Climate Agreement to prevent the most devastating consequences of the climate crisis. Speaking with The Guardian and the Brazilian news outlet Suma Uma, ahead of next month's COP30 climate summit in Brazil, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said it's now inevitable humanity will overshoot the 1.5-degree target set by the Paris Climate Agreement with devastating consequences for the world.
So overshooting is now inevitable. And so it is absolutely indispensable to change course in order to make sure that that overshooting is as small as possible. And this is a basic condition to avoid tipping points. We don't want to see the Amazon as a savanna, but that is a real risk if we don't change course and if we don't take a dramatic decrease of emissions as soon as possible.
Democracy Now! Will be in Belém, Brazil. covering the UN climate summit. In the Gaza Strip, aid organizations warn the amount of food and other basic goods Israel's allowed to enter the Palestinian territory continues to fall far short of the 600 truckloads per day promised under Israel's ceasefire agreement. The UN says the daily number of trucks allowed into Gaza has never passed 200 on any single day in October. Meanwhile, thousands of Palestinians are returning to neighborhoods. Israel forced them to evacuate only to find their homes in rubble. According to the UN Migration Agency, an estimated 90% of all buildings in Gaza are destroyed or damaged. This is Amal Taleb Alyan, a Palestinian from the Al-Shati refugee camp whose home was flattened by Israeli strikes.
We took the house keys. Here they are, the house keys. We took them so we would come back and find the house. But when the truce happened, we returned and we didn't find the house. We didn't even find the door. Every day when I come here, I feel like my soul leaves me. This is where I used to go, where I used to walk. This is my place, my home, my house. Here I built my life. Here I built dreams for me and the children. It's very hard to lose your home.
In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed three Palestinian fighters during an early morning raid on a village near the city of Jenin. The raid sparked heavy exchanges of gunfire, prompting Israel's military to call in airstrikes. This comes as the Israeli defense minister, Israel Katz, is pledging his forces will remain in Palestinian refugee camps in the northern West Bank until at least the end of the year. Israeli attacks in the West Bank have killed more than 1,000 Palestinians over the past 2 years, including 213 children. U.S. officials who closely examined the 2022 shooting death of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in the occupied West Bank were deeply divided over the Biden administration's public conclusions, with some officials convinced her killing was intentional. That's according to the New York Times, citing five current and former U.S. officials who worked on the case, including a career military policeman with 30 years' experience. Speaking publicly for the first time, Colonel Steve Gavovich said the U.S. government had soft-pedaled the office's findings to appease the Israeli government. He said he and his colleagues were left flabbergasted by the Biden State Department statement attributing Abu Akleh's killing to, quote, tragic circumstances. The colonel also spoke with journalist Mehdi Hassan of the news outlet Zateo.
My findings were beyond reasonable doubt that this was an intentional killing of Shireen Abu Akleh.
This is on the 19th or 20th of May, 2022.
Yes.
This is within 10 days
yes.
of her killing.
Yes.
You, on behalf of the United States government, are saying that beyond reasonable doubt, that's a legal standard in a criminal court.
Yes, it is.
She was intentionally killed.
Correct.
Venezuelan officials say they've captured a group of mercenaries tied to the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. In a statement, the government of Venezuela said, quote, this is a colonial operation of military aggression that seeks to turn the Caribbean into a space for lethal violence and U.S. imperial domination, unquote. Earlier this month, President Trump acknowledged he authorized the CIA to secretly conduct operations in Venezuela. On Sunday, a U.S. warship arrived in Trinidad and Tobago, leading Venezuela to cancel energy agreements with the Caribbean nation. Here's Venezuela's vice president and oil minister, Delcy Rodriguez.
Estados Unidos contra Venezuela. No es un conflicto.
It's not a conflict. It's aggression from the United States, a militaristic aggression against Venezuela. President Maduro has said it. It's about Venezuela's oil and gas.
The U.S. federal government shutdown has entered its 28th day. On Monday, American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's top federal workers union, called on Congress to immediately end the shutdown by passing a spending bill that does not include the health care measures that Democrats want to protect. Everett Kelly, the president of the American Federation of Government Employees, said in a statement, quote, it's time to pass a clean, continuing resolution and end this shutdown today. No half measures and no gamesmanship, he said. This comes as the Department of Agriculture posted a notice on its website stating no federal food aid will go out November 1st. Meanwhile, President Trump has stated he will not tap into a contingency fund of $5 billion to keep SNAP, that's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, running. 1 in 8 Americans rely on SNAP food assistance. Indiana's Republican governor called for a special legislative session Monday to redraw the state's congressional map, stating if Indiana doesn't take action, quote, we'll have consequences of not working with the Trump administration as tightly as we should, unquote. The proposal could allow Republicans to win all nine of Indiana's congressional seats. It follows similar efforts by Republicans to successfully redraw maps in their favor in Missouri, North Carolina, and Texas. President Trump's urging the Justice Department to investigate the 2020 election, writing on social media, quote, I hope the DOJ pursues this with as much gusto as befitting the biggest scandal in American history, unquote. Earlier this month, the Trump administration appointed Kurt Olson, a former Trump campaign lawyer, as a special government employee to work on election issues. Speaking to The Wall Street Journal, officials said Olson has started asking intelligence agencies about information related to the 2020 election. This comes as the Trump administration's instructed the Justice Department to send observers to New Jersey and California to monitor polling sites during elections next week. Californians are set to vote on a ballot proposition that would redraw the state's congressional districts, allowing Democrats to possibly pick up five additional seats in Congress. Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom called the Trump administration's moves as intimidation tactic, while California's Attorney General Rob Bonta said, quote, all indications, all arrows show this is a tee-up for something more dangerous in the 2026 midterms and beyond. President Trump met Japan's newly elected ultra-nationalist prime minister, Sanaya Takeuchi, in Tokyo Tuesday as he continued a six-day trip to Asia. The pair agreed to cooperate on expanding the supply chain for rare earth metals and promised to expand military cooperation, with Takeuchi reiterating a pledge to increase Japan's military spending to at least 2% of gross domestic product. During their summit, she repeatedly flattered Trump, saying she plans to nominate him for a Nobel Peace Prize.
In such a short period of time, the world has become more peaceful. I highly value President Trump's unwavering commitment to world peace and stability. I myself have been deeply impressed and inspired by you.
Earlier today, Japan's first female prime minister joined President Trump aboard an aircraft carrier at a U.S. naval base in Yokosuka, where Trump told active duty soldiers he plans to keep using the National Guard to occupy American cities and that he might deploy soldiers from other military branches as well. This comes ahead of Trump's trip to a summit in South Korea, where he'll meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping on Thursday. It's unclear if he will also be meeting with the North Korean leader on this trip. In Cameroon, the world's oldest president, 92-year-old Paul Biya, was reelected Monday to an eighth term in office. This follows days of protests during which security forces killed four people. Cameroon's top court ruled Biya won the majority of the votes, but the opposition contested the result. Recently, dozens of opposition supporters and activists and leaders had been arrested. And in the Ivory Coast, 83-year-old incumbent president Alassane Ouattara has won a fourth term in office after an election that saw two of his main rivals disqualified. About half of eligible voters cast ballots, far fewer than the roughly 80% who voted in the 2010-11 elections when Ouattara was first elected. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The United Nations is repeating its call for an immediate ceasefire in Sudan after the UAE-backed rapid support forces seized control of the city of Al-Fashir in Darfur after a 17-month siege. On Monday, the head of the African Union called for the opening of humanitarian corridors to allow life-saving aid to reach those in need. The African Union also condemned reports of war crimes in Al-Fashir. One group allied with the Sudanese military has claimed the RSF has, quote, executed more than 2,000 unarmed civilians, unquote, since taking control of Al-Fashir. The fall of the city is seen as a major blow to the Sudanese military. On Monday, Sudan's army chief, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, announced the withdrawal of his soldiers from their last stronghold in Darfur.
Everyone has followed what has happened in Al-Fashir. Certainly the leadership there, including security, made assessments that they have to leave the city due to the systemic destruction and killing of civilians. We agreed with them to leave the city and to go to a safe place so as to spare the rest of the citizens and the rest of the city from destruction.
On Monday, the UN humanitarian coordinator in Sudan, Denise Brown, warned of the escalating humanitarian crisis in El Fasher and throughout Sudan.
There's been a blockade for now over 500 days, a blockade of humanitarian assistance going in for those civilians. So I just want to reiterate, there are civilians in El Fasher. It is a fact. And once again, and we've said it dozens of times, the UN calls on the RSF to allow safe passage for them to leave, particularly as the fighting has intensified over the past 24 hours. These individuals are at increased risk of being injured or killed. OHCHR has just a few minutes ago reported on a multitude of reports of summary executions of unarmed men and civilians in El Fasher.
The Sudanese military and the UAE-backed RSF have been fighting since 2023. Since then, more than 150,000 people have died across Sudan. About 12 million have fled their homes. We go now to Maureen Al-Neil, a Sudanese activist, usually joins us from Khartoum or in Sudan, but is now in Nairobi, Kenya. Maureen, can you talk about the significance of the RSF taking over Fasher, the role of the UAE, and the level of famine in this city, what it means for the whole country?
The most important aspect of the RSF taking control of El Fasher is the humanitarian aspect. We've seen the situation in El Fasher in the months of the siege, which were about 18 months of siege. And during that time, the RSF built barricades from sand that just completely surrounded the city, making sure that no one goes in or out except through one, what they called a safe corridor, and it was anything but safe. People were facing multiple violations through that route. And during the time of the siege, we've seen the level of famine in El Fasher rise to something we've not seen in other areas in Sudan. Even just a sack of millet, which is the staple or was the staple in El Fasher, rose to over $1,000. And people started basically depending on animal feeding to feed themselves and their families. And that has been the situation for months. So now with the RSF taking over the city and entering the city and taking over the 6th Infantry of the Sudanese Armed Forces, the biggest fear is what's going to happen to the civilians. We know that the RSF does not differentiate between military and civilians, and they've been explicitly saying there are no civilians in El Fasher, which is not the reality. So this is the fear now, what's going to happen to the civilians, and we're already seeing grave violations happening to the people, executions, detentions, targeting of volunteers, targeting of journalists. We've seen the detention of journalists as well. And when it comes to what does this mean for the war in Sudan in total, this just shows us that what the Sudanese armed forces have been promising, which is military victory that is going to end the war, is nowhere near happening. And if they keep insisting that they must win with a military victory, then this is just going to prolong the war more and more and causing more civilians harm, because both parties are indiscriminately attacking, whether these are civilians or from the other warring party, and also indiscriminately attacking infrastructure. They've attacked healthcare infrastructure. About 80% of the hospitals are out of service now, and let alone all the medical staff that have also fled the country. So we're seeing with the harms that the war is causing, we're also seeing the healthcare situation deteriorating very quickly. And this is something that is impacting places like North Darfur very heavily and also impacting the rest of the country.
And could you talk, Maureen, about the significance of the city of El Fasher to the both sides, why they have fought so hard now for so long over control of the city?
Yeah, well, it is the last stronghold of the Sudanese armed forces in Darfur. And this is one of the fears that is also a lot of Sudanese people are afraid of facing, or afraid that the country will face now, is the prospect of having basically two governments, because already the RSF have announced a parallel government. And now with them taking control of Al Fasher and also taking control about 2 days ago of Bara, which is another strategic city in North Kordofan. So the fear of having two governments now, which will lead to longer destabilization that could not being able to end it, whether military or through negotiations. Since SAF is not accepting any negotiations at the time, there are no negotiations happening directly or indirectly. So with the RSF taking control of Al Fasher, this fear is growing about having the country destabilized for longer, about having two governments, and also the fear of the back and forth of RSF taking control and SAF taking control of areas which causes more and more violations. Every time you have this movement of the two warring parties, you see a spike in humanitarian violations. You see a spike in gender-based violence and sexual violence, and you see obviously a spike in detention and executions, extrajudicial executions that are being done by both parties, accusing civilians, or maybe not civilians, we don't know because there are no trials happening, accusing them of collaborating with the other party and executing them extrajudicially based on that.
And could you talk about the role of outside powers in this war, specifically the United Arab Emirates or other regional powers? What do they have to gain from continuing to stoke this war?
Well, the United Arab Emirates is playing multiple roles in this war. We know that it has been backing the rapid support forces. And on the other hand, it still has relations with the government that's Sudanese armed forces. And we've seen how big of a role it plays on the other side as well, especially recently when the air flights between Port Sudan and the UAE were stopped. And we've seen that the amount of gold imports that have been halted due to that. So the UAE has a vested interest in Sudan, has been supporting the rapid support forces, and at the same time, it is continuing to have relations with the Sudanese armed forces. So I think that the lack of stability does facilitate more importing of gold from Sudan that is not being regulated. And at the same time, they're still also importing the legally gold from Sudan. And at the same time, the UAE is part of the Quad that is trying to lead negotiations between the two warring parties. And the existence of UAE in that Quad has been one of the reasons that's being stated by the Sudanese armed forces as a reason that they cannot trust the Quad to lead these negotiations. So we know that the United Arab Emirates can have a lot of impact. It can control or at least impact the flow of weapons and ammunition to the rapid support forces. It can also pressure the Sudanese armed forces through their economic relationship. And it can also impact both parties through its contribution in the Quad. So they're able to influence the situation to something better if that was their priority. But we know very well that the priority is the economic gains that they have from Sudan.
So finally, Maureen Al-Neil, what do you feel can be done at this point? What is civil society calling for? Talk about what the UN, and we're speaking to you from the United States, what the United States can do. What does civil society want?
At this moment, what's important, we have an urgent situation that is happening now in El Fasher. So there is a need for urgent help. There is a need for having the aid reach the people. We've had over 1,000 families fleeing El Fasher and reaching Tawila, a nearby town. And all of these people are in need of, are in desperate need of humanitarian assistance. That needs to be organized. There are groups that are working on the ground. There are community-based groups, there are grassroots groups that are working on the ground and that can be supported. And when we're talking, on the other hand, what can be done from the United States, I think, I mean, the United States is also part of the Quad, so people in the United States can work on influencing the United States by prioritizing the safety of the people and the livelihoods of the people. We've heard the special envoy of the U.S. say that their main concern, this was before the takeover of al-Fashr, their main concern, they said, is the relations between the Sudanese armed forces and Islamic movements. And I think it's important to move the main concern from any power-sharing prospects to what is happening to the people now on the ground, especially when we have such a dire situation. And another area that can be also very impactful is to see some seriousness in the measures that the U.S. is taking. We've seen them impose sanctions on a number of Rapid Support Forces leaders, while at the same time there are reports of Rapid Support Forces leaders roaming freely in Washington, D.C., actually. So there is a question of how serious are these measures that are being taken against the perpetrators to try to pressure them to prioritize the humanitarian situation right now and pressure them into at least a humanitarian ceasefire like the Quad has suggested for 3 months. There can be more seriousness taken into these measures. So we can see the warring parties prioritizing also the safety of the Sudanese people, because at this moment, and as we've seen for 2 years, the priority of both warring parties was reaching power, basically, while the international actors' priorities have been related to economic interests, as well as interest in not destabilizing the entire region.
Maureen O'Neill, I want to thank you for being with us. Sudanese activists joining us from Nairobi, Kenya. Coming up, the government shutdown enters its 28th day. 42 million Americans will soon lose federal food assistance. We'll look at why millions are seeing soaring health care premiums and what can be done about it. Stay with us.
Woke with a feeling. Tomorrow is coming, some new hope is around the bend. And it's beaming through the lens, woke up feeling I could be alright, under the door is the holy light. Things are gonna be alright.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The U.S. federal government shutdown has entered its 20th day. On Friday, more than 1.4 million federal workers missed their first full paychecks. This is furloughed federal worker Anthony Spade in line at a food bank in Washington, D.C.
So today is my normally I would get paid today. I don't have no paycheck in my account. I still have bills that are due. I have a family that I have to take care of. So it's a lot of uncertainty that comes along with this. I'm grateful for these opportunities to receive assistance, but there is a lot of uncertainty that comes along with it, and it causes a lot of stress as well.
Now the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's top federal workers union, is calling on Congress to immediately end the shutdown by passing a bill without agreeing to demands from Democrats to extend health care subsidies from the Affordable Care Act that are set to expire Saturday, November 1st, doubling premiums for some 20 million people. As many federal workers turn to food pantries, the Department of Agriculture says it'll cut food aid to some 42 million people who rely on SNAP, that Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, starting Saturday. President Trump